This is episode 92 of Beyond the Bulletin, published on June 18th, 2021. Hello and welcome to episode 92 of Beyond the Bulletin. From the University of Waterloo, I'm Brandon Sweet, editor of the Daily Bulletin.
And from Media Relations, I'm Pamela Smythe.
On this podcast, we go beyond the pages and pixels of the Daily Bulletin to inform you about important news and views from our community.
In the interview, Amir Al-Azraqi, the coordinator of studies in Islamic and Arab cultures at Renison University College. We discuss Islamophobia after a motorist hit and killed several members of a Muslim family in London, Ontario.
New episodes of the podcast come out every week, and you can find our archive of past shows and helpful links on SoundCloud.com. Please recommend us to your colleagues and connections at Waterloo. Thank you for joining us as we go beyond the bulletin.
So big week this week.
It is indeed the biggest week in the academic calendar, you might say.
Yes, yes. Convocation. It's such an exciting time. I wish that it was happening on campus.
Yes, we certainly miss something without the pomp and circumstance. Or is it pomp and ceremony? Or is it circumstance and ceremony? Anyhow.
Circumstantial ceremony?
Well, it's anything but circumstantial because the evidence is right there in the diploma that you get. You worked hard. Here's your sheepskin.
Ew.
Is it? That's what they call it, right? Sheepskin?
Yeah, I don't think they call it that anymore.
So here's what's been happening. In COVID-19 news, the province of Ontario announced that Waterloo is among one of seven regions where people will be able to book their second dose of an mRNA COVID-19 vaccine earlier than originally scheduled due to the spread of the Delta variant of concern.
Beginning Monday, June 14th, individuals who live in Halton, Peel, Porcupine, Toronto, Waterloo, Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph, and York public health units, and who also received their first dose on or before May 9th, will be eligible to book their accelerated second dose appointment. And these individuals will be able to book through the provincial booking system, directly through public health units that use their own booking system, and through participating pharmacies. God, wouldn't that be awful if you got it on May 10th?
Yeah, just outside of the cutoff. Pisk, pisk.
That would be bad. If it's you listening, we're so sorry.
Since the initial announcement, it was also announced that the second dose wait time for those individuals who received AstraZeneca as their first dose has been reduced from 12 weeks to 8 weeks.
Those who got AstraZeneca as a first dose will have the option of getting a second dose of the same vaccine or an mRNA vaccine, either Pfizer or Moderna. As of now, you know, we have the highest rate of infection in Ontario. We're worse off than Peel. We're number one.
At last, our greatness has been recognized, but unfortunately it was recognized by a virus. The president's town hall took place on Tuesday, June 15th. Nearly 1,200 staff and faculty watched the virtual event on Microsoft Teams. This town hall was a follow-up to the recent return to campus town hall held in May. Joining President Ferdinand Hamdallah on the virtual stage, providing extra context and updates, were Provost Jim Rush, Associate Provost Cooperative and Experiential Education, Nora McRae, Associate Provost Human Resources, Marilyn Thompson, Medical Director Clark Baldwin, Director of Safety, Kate Windsor, Pharmacy Professor Kelly Grinrod, and Executive Director of Plant Operations, Stepanka Elias.
It's a veritable who's who of subject matter experts in these trying times.
Indeed. There was also a robust question and answer period, moderated by event host and Vice President University Relations, Sandra Banks. People submitted questions in advance and asked some during the event in the chat. Topics included mask etiquette, employee vaccinations, lecture hall capacity, return to work, and vaccinations for international students, among others. The event also ended with some personal reflections from Ferdinand Hamdallah on his years of leadership at the University of Waterloo.
University Communications will be posting the town hall video and a detailed Q&A document online in the coming days. Please check the Daily Bulletin for more information. This was Ferdinand's last town hall.
It was, actually, and there are some really touching moments near the end that I won't spoil because you should go back if you missed it and watch the event itself. But There's a surprise cameo appearance and, again, some really heartfelt thoughts about leadership at the university that were a very nice way to wrap things up.
Yeah, it was nice.
The University of Waterloo is among the top 150 universities in the world, according to QS World University Rankings, an annual publication of comparative data about university performance. One of 1,300 institutions that were ranked, Waterloo placed 149th in the 2022 ranking, 17 spots higher than its 2021 mark of 166th. Waterloo's ranking among Canadian institutions remained stable at 7th out of 28, but saw the largest overall improvement for Canadian universities in the top 150 over 1 year.
We're number 149! We're number 149! The university's strongest indicators include: we're now at 76th or 4th in Canada in terms of higher ability. 75,000 employers were asked to rank university graduates in terms of their higher ability. And citations for faculty, we improved to 80th place, 3rd in Canada. This measures the average number of citations obtained per faculty member and is a measure of the impact and quality of the scientific work produced by universities. We'll put the link to the QS rankings in our episode show notes on SoundCloud.
Now, here's what's coming up. And as we've mentioned already, it's that time of year, Pamela. Convocation time.
Woohoo!
The spring 2021 convocation ceremonies will be taking place on July 17th, 18th, and 19th. 6,887 students will be crossing the virtual stage in six ceremonies. So you could call it 6,887 degrees of convocation.
At this point, we're no stranger to celebrating convocation virtually. However, this spring, the university will be celebrating its graduates with online ceremonies rather than via targeted emails.
Now, the actual six ceremonies will take place on Friday, June 18th and Saturday, June 19th. All graduates, their families, and the university community are invited to the faculty-specific virtual ceremonies throughout the day, with Health, Environment, and Mathematics on Friday, June 18th, and Arts, Science, and Engineering on Saturday, June 19th. There's also a special PhD graduation celebration event happening on the evening of Thursday, June 17th.
You can share photos and congratulatory remarks online to honor the class of 2021. Please use the hashtag UWaterlooGrad when sharing your content on social media. That's capital U, capital W, capital G, UWaterlooGrad. For more information, visit the convocation website. We'll put the link in our episode show notes. And from both of us at Beyond the Bulletin, congratulations!
2021 marks the 25th anniversary of National Indigenous Peoples Day in Canada, a day to celebrate the heritage, diverse cultures, and outstanding achievements of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Throughout June, the University of Waterloo has been marking National Indigenous History Month in a number of ways. The Indigenous Initiatives Office has launched a trivia challenge for National Indigenous History Month. Each Friday, they will release a new trivia question, and campus community members have until Monday night to provide their answer. Each correct answer is entered into a draw to win a unique prize pack. The prize packs are different each week and are made up of books, art, jewelry, or other creations made by Indigenous artists. We'll put a link to the trivia contest in our show notes on SoundCloud.
The Indigenous Initiatives Office is offering a chance to stream artist, musician, and creator Is Quay in her performance with the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony. We'll put the registration link in our show notes on SoundCloud.
And while we're on the topic of artistic performances, on Monday, June 21st, Indigenous Initiatives is hosting an event with Deantha Edmonds, Canada's first and only Inuk professional classical singer. An urban Inuk, Edmonds aims to empower Indigenous people and share their stories. We'll put that registration link in our episode show notes on SoundCloud as well.
And speaking of show notes, we had it in our show notes before when Jean Becker was the interview guest on the show, and so we're going to share it again. The Daily Bulletin on Monday, June 21st will contain an excerpt of my conversation with our Senior Director, Indigenous Initiatives, and Interim AVP, Human Rights, Equity, and Inclusion. That was back in episode 90. We discussed the recent painful discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former residential school in Kamloops and implications for truth and reconciliation in Canada.
And now the interview. The university mourns the loss of four members of the same family in London, Ontario, after a motorist drove into them while they were out for a walk together on June 6th. A 9-year-old boy is the only survivor, and he suffered serious injuries. The police say this was a deliberate act, and the driver targeted the family because of their Muslim faith. Amir Al-Azraqi is a professor of Arabic language, literature, and culture, as well as the coordinator of studies in Islamic and Arab cultures at Renison University College. He is here to talk about Islamophobia in our communities.
Thank you for joining me, Amir.
Thank you for having me, Pamela.
Madha Salman, her husband Salman Afzal, their children Yumna and Fayez, and Salman's mother Talat were all out for a stroll on a Sunday when they were hit in what many are saying was a premeditated, hate-motivated act of Islamophobia by a terrorist. I will just mention that the man in custody has not yet been convicted. I'm choosing not to say his name. What were your thoughts when you heard?
I think the tragedy that happened in London was not a random or isolated incident. I think it was a culminating scene of the violence and hatred Muslims face daily in Canada. There is evidence of this in the studies, and I have personally witnessed Islamophobia. I mean, look at the statistics. The number of anti-Muslims hate crimes increased from 166 incidents in 2018 to 181 in 2019. These are only the reported ones. I can give you a lot of statistics. I can share with you if you allow me.
Yes, please.
I mean, according to the survey done by Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, Canadians are least comfortable with a figure of authority who wears a hijab versus any other type of religious garb. Canadians are more likely to harbor negative stereotypes about Muslim Canadians than about Christian or Jewish Canadians. Canadians are far less comfortable welcoming a Muslim into their family versus people of other religious faiths. Canadians believe in the protection of religious rights generally, but are less concerned for the religious rights of their Muslim co-citizens. And also I can share with you some of the perceptions according to the report that's submitted to the UN by the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, Islamic Social Services Association, and Noor Cultural Center in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
According to the report, public perception of Islam and Muslims, according to the report and according to the survey findings, 46% of Canadians have an unfavorable view of Islam more than for any other religious tradition. 56% of Canadians believe that Islam suppresses women's rights. More than half of people living in Ontario feel mainstream Muslim doctrines promote violence. 52% of Canadians feel that Muslims can only be trusted a little or not at all.
Wow.
42% of Canadians think discrimination against Muslims is mainly their fault. And 47% of Canadians support banning headscarves in public. And 51% support government surveillance of mosques.
Ugh. I mean, that does show how big a problem Islamophobia is in Canada. I personally am surprised to hear those numbers, but perhaps I shouldn't be.
Well, Islamophobia is honestly a Canadian problem. It's not a Muslim problem only. Muslims are not a separate community. They are equally part of Canadian society. The majority of Canadians are unaware of how deeply Islam and Muslims are woven into the life of this country. When there is a threat to any group in Canadian society, it is a threat to the well-being of all Canadian society.
That's true.
I am originally from Iraq. I came to Canada in 2007 as a PhD student. After finishing my PhD, I decided to stay in Canada because at that time I fell in love with its idealistic picture as the best place to live peacefully and coexist with all these cultures while my rights are protected. Unfortunately, after these 14 years, this idealistic image is shattered. The longer I lived in Canada, the more I discovered certain things that are not what I thought in the beginning. As a Muslim, an Arab Muslim who came to Canada in 2007 and lived here for 14 years, I can give you examples of, like a few examples of what I've, from my life that show racism and Islamophobia in Canada.
Okay.
2 years ago in Guelph, I live in Guelph, I was walking toward the entrance of Stone Road Mall. I don't know if you know where it is, but...
Yes, I do.
A car approached fast, and I didn't see it. So the driver missed the stop sign, and he almost ran me over. So I yelled. I said, "There is a stop sign here." And the driver yelled back, and unfortunately, he said, "Go back to your... Sorry to say that. Go back to the F... to your F country." That's just really like a small example.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Thank you. A friend of mine, she's a Muslim friend who lives in Kitchener. Mm-hmm. And she's been really stopped many times by her neighbors when she goes on walks, asking if she lives in the neighborhood. So her neighbor stops her every time she goes for a walk, even though she lives there, and they stop her asking if she lives in the neighborhood. She was also called names and harassed while walking in downtown Kitchener. Are these coincidences? Or maybe they are connected to an underlying prejudice.
Now, you lived in Canada for 14 years. Have you always been on the receiving end of ignorant comments? No. Racist comments?
No, it would be unfair to say that all my experience is like that at all. Sometimes I feel lucky that I live in a really very friendly place like Guelph, even though I had a few bad experiences. And this is the first time I share my experience, by the way. But I feel lucky to have... non-Muslim friends and colleagues who are really supportive, understanding, and very kind people.
Well, thank you for being open and sharing.
Thank you for listening.
This attack on a Muslim family is not the only violent act of Islamophobia that Canada has seen. It's not even the only deadly one. In January of 2017, six people were killed and five others were injured when a man with a semi-automatic pistol went on a shooting rampage in the Islamic Culture Center of Quebec City. The man responsible pleaded guilty. Politicians called it terrorism, and the same for this most recent act. And we know that the accused is now facing terrorism charges. So, in addition to attempted murder and first-degree murder. What do you think about the fact that people are calling it terrorism? Would you agree with that?
Like, I'm not a legal expert here, but mm-hmm. From a human point of view, I think it should be considered as an act of terror, terrorism, because killing people simply because of their faith is an act of terrorism. It's horrible what happened in London, as I said, because Muslims and many other people who come to Canada just to live peacefully and not to be violently targeted because of their faiths and because of what they believe in.
What do you want people to know about Islam? Things that they obviously don't understand.
First of all, Islam is not an ethnicity. Islam is a religion that includes all kinds of people, that includes all different cultures from around the world. Mm-hmm. I can't call it Muslim culture. I prefer to call it Muslim cultures because a lot of cultures under this faith, this religion. Right. So we cannot, and even like, if I want to include even people from like white people who are Muslims as well. So it's a religion that includes different kind of people, different kind of cultures. What I want to indicate here is a lot of these hatred crimes occur mostly because of ignorance of the core message of Islam and the values of Islam. It occurs also because of their ignorance of the Muslim community. They don't know the culture of Muslims. I mean, most of the, unfortunately, most of the like people around the world who are not Muslims, are deceived by what the media shows them, which is mostly stereotype about Muslims. Very negative and demonized vision, image of Muslims in the media. So they don't know the truth about Islam and Muslims. And I just want to make sure that people don't misunderstand me, that I am promoting that the idea that this religion or all Muslims are perfect. No, I'm not saying that.
Who is?
Exactly. Who is perfect? That's right. So what I'm saying is part of the problem lies in the ignorance of the people of Islam and Muslims. Mm-hmm. So raising awareness about this issue requires that we come close. We try to understand the other. We try to understand Muslims. We try to read and educate ourselves about Islam and Muslims. Go to your Muslim neighbors and have a talk, have a chit-chat, learn about their life, and you will see there, after all, they are human beings. They share humanity. They share all these human values that we have as people living together.
I'm thinking that popular culture hasn't done a very good job of portraying Muslim cultures either. Actually, a classmate of mine from when I was in journalism school, Zarqa Nawaz, she is the creator of Little Mosque on the Prairie.
Oh, wow.
Which was do you watch that? Have you seen that show?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
Oh, you have to see that show. Yes. It's based on her actual experience living in Saskatchewan, where there was no mosque. And so a church shared their space. And so like half the time, I guess it was a mosque and the other half, it was a church. And then it's sort of this, you know, small town, Saskatchewan. Actually, I think she was in Regina, but anyway, it's about the two cultures.
Very interesting.
Yes. Oh, you must watch it.
Okay. Oh, fantastic. Thank you for letting me know about that. I will definitely check it out.
Good. I'm glad.
I just want to make sure that I'm not being pessimistic here or giving the gloomy that everything in Canada is, you know, gloomy or bad. I mean, there are ills in every society. As you said, we are not perfect. So wherever you go, you will face certain problems. And our topic today is Islamophobia. And Islamophobia is not only in Canada, honestly. Islamophobia and mostly like in the West, but it's not only in Canada. So I still appreciate being here in Canada, living here, having such wonderful group of friends, close to be family, even though all my family, my relatives are back home. Honestly, most of my friends are non-Muslims. And I feel really lucky to be among them. And I feel lucky to be here in Canada. But this does not deny the fact that as Muslims here, and as Canadians in general, we are facing this problem of Islamophobia. If you allow me, hatred against Muslim does not begin with a truck driver killing innocent Muslim people on the sidewalk. It certainly begins with a simple bigotry in our homes, in schools, workplaces, and communities. Islamophobia is a form of hidden racism. Anti-Muslim racism reinforces structural oppression.
Does someone have to be Muslim to experience Islamophobia?
Not necessarily. People can be mistaken for Muslim by the public based on stereotypes, based on names, dress, skin color, etc. For example, Sikh people have been mistaken for Muslims and been targets of Islamophobia.
What role do you think that this university, can play in addressing and eliminating Islamophobia?
Well, the university is a place of knowledge creation and has a responsibility to nurture students into good global citizens. University can directly address anti-Muslim attitudes through actively creating safe spaces and educational opportunities for intercultural dialogue, such as inviting speakers, lectures, seminars, events, forums, etc. Also, the university can reach out to the public, to those that don't attend university can still be positively impacted by the university. For example, public events such as the Arab Culture Festival that I organize it, and we have it every year at Renison University College, which plays a role in celebrating Arabs and changing stereotypes on Muslims and Arabs.
When is that?
Every year we have it in the fall, but last year we didn't have it because of COVID. Right. Yeah. The other role that university can play is to support students' initiatives, such as the Muslim Students Association, which can engage students through annual conferences, ongoing campus programs, and events. There is another aspect that the university can play a role in, mm-hmm. which is to promote community-engaged scholarship, specifically meaningful partnership with Muslim groups to do research that is relevant to, for them. In that kind of scholarship, the community identifies the problem to be researched and guides the research design and ensure the research is relevant.
What do you cover in the Studies in Islamic and Arab Cultures program that you coordinate?
Yeah, I mean, the program is a multi and interdisciplinary, where Islam, its people, and its insights are studied in the context of other religious, cultural, and social traditions or issues. Students in the program, they study Islamic and Arab cultures in the fine arts, language, literature, drama, history, politics, science, anthropology, social development, gender and sex, Arab culture, and a myriad of other disciplines. The goal of the program is to bring together multiple perspectives and teach students how to deconstruct essentialist caricatures of religion, of cultures, of genders, and other labels that lend themselves to stereotypes. I am also a theater practitioner. I use a theater of the oppressed to address issues related to social, like social justice issues and human rights issues. Theater of the Oppressed originated in 1960s and was developed by a Brazilian theater director. His name is Augusto Boal.
Oh.
So Boal created this theatrical practice where the audience ceased to be passive receivers of the performance on a stage and become more active participants in it. The Theater of the Oppressed is also considered as a unique democratic and interactive platform. One of the techniques of Theater of the Oppressed called forum theater that I use usually to address the issues related to, as I said, social justice and human rights. Theater of the Oppressed, and in particular forum theater, is like a theatrical game that seeks to motivate people, restore true dialogue, and create a space for participant to rehearse for change. The main goal of Theater of the Oppressed is to turn the spectators everywhere, like it doesn't have to be in a studio or in a theater space, but in anywhere, if you do Theater of the Oppressed in the street, etc., spectators become spect actors.
Mm.
So it means the true involvement, the interaction of the audience with the action on stage. Their involvement is very important in providing solution for that problem on stage.
The audience is involved in a scene where someone's being oppressed or there is an oppressor.
Mm-hmm. And this performance dramatizes an issue regarded as a problematic in the community. It could be, and usually it's an oppression, but different scenarios of oppression. The same performance is then repeated. And during that second performance, the audience members are encouraged to participate through improvisation with the aim of changing the outcome of the story. So the actors make changes to the original script according to the intervention made by the spect actors, not the spectators. And then at the end, the actors perform the amended version of the script, enabling the spect actors to experience the result of their participation.
Wow.
And it's based on improvisation, and the audience members in this particular type of theater, they are no longer passive. The audience will intervene either by suggesting something to the actor or by replacing one of the actors. And usually they're not allowed to replace the oppressor. You know why?
Because nobody wants to be the oppressor and say those awful things. That would be my problem.
There are other reasons as well, because in reality, in real life, it's really hard to replace the oppressor easily. So the idea is to empower the oppressed to face the oppressor and to face oppression.
I think it was after a particular Islamophobic incident. And I remember seeing on social media an infographic of a woman in hijab, and she was on the bus sitting on a seat. And a man on the bus was harassing her and saying racist things at her. What the infographic suggested you do was not focus on the person who's saying the awful racist things, but that I, as somebody who's witnessing this, it would be more productive and helpful if I got up and sat beside the woman and then just started talking to her, just focused on her and not necessarily about this particular incident. It could be, isn't it raining a lot lately or whatever? Is that something that we would see, we would learn in Theater of the Oppressed?
I would say if bystanders engage the oppressor, they could escalate the violence. It is more effective to focus your energy on the oppressed. In the moment, you cannot change the oppressor, but you can promote the safety of the oppressed. Also, in the Theater of the Oppressed, we demonstrate that if a bystander supports the oppressed, other bystanders may join in their support. And this intervention changes passive spectators, like bystanders, into active actors, as I said before, and make them allies to the oppressed, which renders the oppressor powerless. So it's a more collective effort to help the oppressed. And I'm sure when the oppressor, I'm talking about the example you gave, someone in the bus, the oppressor, and see all the people against him or her or them, I would say they will back up. It will not solve the problem itself as much as this practice creates good citizens who are responsible towards each other.
Wow, it sounds fascinating. I would like to see that.
Of course.
Or act that or whatever.
So I've been working and collaborating with some colleagues here at the University of Waterloo. And recently I got a grant from Ryerson University College to do a workshop for faculty to be trained in forum theater, to use it in classroom as a pedagogical tool.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. That sounds like more than just faculty members should be allowed to do that. So
We'll be involved, like students will be involved in that as well, but mainly it focused on using Theater of the Oppressed, I mean, in particular, forum theater as a pedagogical tool in addressing issues related to teaching and learning in classrooms.
Since the attack in London, I've seen tweets and posts from people I know who are Muslim who are saying they're concerned for their parents to go out for a walk, or they're concerned for their kids to go out for a walk, or even just go outside. I think maybe we could offer to go for a walk with them in addition to the intervening in a positive way and of the way that focuses on them if they're ever in, if we ever witness them in a situation that is racist.
I mean, Canadians, if they want to show some solidarity, if they want to address the problem, they have to take an action and not to wait for politicians or the government to come together. And we have to address this problem. The action taken against Islamophobia need to be an ongoing effort, not just a reaction to tragedies that fade out. I would like to quote Angela Davis. She's an American political activist, philosopher, and she's a professor at the University of California. She says, in a racist society, it is not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist. And I'd like to quote her words. And I would like to say, in such Islamophobic society, It is not enough to be non-Islamophobic. We must be anti-Islamophobic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here, Amir Alazraki. It's been a really good conversation, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Pamela. Thank you for having me, and have a wonderful day.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please subscribe to the Beyond the Bulletin podcast wherever you get your podcasts and recommend us to your colleagues and Waterloo alumni.
Stay safe, everyone, and remember, do your part to limit the spread of COVID-19 in our community. You can get in touch with us via email at bulletin@uwaterloo.ca.
As always, thanks for listening as we went Beyond the Bulletin.
How much longer is your renovation going to be, Brandon?
The goalposts, they keep shifting.
What are you doing?
Well, I'm not doing anything, actually. Although I did, I feel like Columbo, because every time they do something, or every time I look at what's been done, I'm like, I turn around and I'm like, oh, just one more thing.